Algorithms are used to solve problems in math, computer programming, and on Wall Street, but you may not be aware that we also use algorithms to tie our shoes and to bake a loaf of bread. On this week's Please Explain, we'll find out what algorithms are and how they work to solve problems both simple and complex. Joining us are Harry Lewis, Gordon McKay Professor of Computer Science at Harvard, and Daniel Bienstock, Professor of Industrial Engineering and Operations Research at Columbia University. Welcome to our show.
Pleasure to be here.
Yes.
And Harry, first, can you give us a definition of what an algorithm is?
An algorithm you've actually explained it pretty well. An algorithm is a description of a sequence of steps that you can carry out to solve some problem. You know, in the computer world, they're usually problems about moving data around or doing numerical calculations or something like that. But the important thing about an algorithm is that the steps have to be stated in a way that is precise and unambiguous, so that you can hand the recipe, as you said, off to somebody else, and if they carried out the steps, they would get the same results on the same data that you got. So it's the fact that it's a formally described process, a process described in precise formal language, that solves some problem.
So I'm assuming that algorithms were around long before anybody called them algorithms.
Well, the great invention in the history of algorithms was the invention of arithmetic, the way we're taught to do it in grade school now, where you represent numbers in decimal notation as strings of digits between 0 and 9. The Romans didn't do it that way, but now you can teach any grade school kid can add up numbers by carrying ones and all the rest of that better than anybody in the Roman civilization could have done it, working with their clumsy notational system. So that actually gives an example of something important about algorithms, that very often the quality of the algorithm and what you can do with the data is very dependent on the way the data is represented. And so that notational invention was actually led to important improvements in algorithms.
The notational change actually came out of India. So
right.
When the Romans were using X's and I's and V's, it was harder actually to think in an algorithmic way. Let me bring Daniel into this.
I wanted to point out that algorithms had actually been around since antiquity. The ancient Greeks,
were they calling them algorithms?
No.
Well, when I'm assuming algorithm and algebra have some kind
yes.
of connection,
there was
at least those names.
A mathematician in Baghdad around the year 800, by the name of Al-Khwarizmi, and when his activities spread to Europe, his name was changed, and thus came the word algorithms.
So from Alcor, we wound up with Al
yes.
Gore.
Yes.
And then he became vice president of the United States. So I guess my question there was, what distinguishes an algorithm from other kinds of problem-solving methods? Or are all problem-solving methods algorithms?
I would take a broader view. I would say that algorithms provide a framework for organizing your thoughts about some activity so that you can render a sequence of steps that is going to help you undertake this activity. There's a notion of effectiveness. You want to accomplish something, and there's a notion of efficiency, that you want to do it quickly with little work.
And so the old Roman way, I'm getting back to a question that never got answered. Was terrible because you couldn't be efficient with it.
Would take forever and very error-prone as a result.
Does all mathematics use algorithms, Harry?
Does all mathematics use algorithms? Well, no, because there are many branches of mathematics that are really only designed to solve other problems in mathematics and not to produce any effective, any effective results. But many algorithms have very, very deep mathematics behind them, and many algorithms that get used in all kinds of areas have drawn very surprisingly on mathematical results which were originally thought to be of no use, no possible use whatsoever. The algorithms that are used for encrypting your password when you log into your bank account, or encrypting the data that flows back and forth across the internet between you and your bank when you make a banking transaction online. There's mathematics behind that was developed, at a time when the people who developed it very proudly said that they were not engineers and they had the joy of working in the realm of pure mathematics that would be totally useless but absolutely beautiful. And lo and behold, in the internet era, it turns out it was actually behind what we know about how to encrypt information. So there's a lot of mathematics behind the design of many algorithms that are in very widespread use today.
So in that case, the math was created, and then somebody saw an application for it?
Exactly.
So, but do when you're trying to create an algorithm, do you start with a desired end result and then work backward, Daniel?
There's an element in the design of algorithms that is reminiscent of solving puzzles. You're not actually sure what it is that you would like to achieve. You may have a goal, a particular, let's say, arcane representation of efficiency, and you would like to achieve that, but you're not quite sure of how you're going to get there. It is closely related to research in mathematics. It takes time. You may fail to do so. You may get only partly there. So it is serendipitous to some degree, but you're informed by your previous research and experience and so on.
Can you explain how algorithms sometimes use randomness in order to be more efficient?
Sure.
Because that seems counterintuitive.
Yes. Let me give you a very simple example, something that actually we encounter frequently nowadays, which is the problem of sorting a list of numbers. Let's say that I gave somebody, you, a list of 10 numbers, and I said, I would like you to sort them from smallest to largest. Very likely you will carry out a certain algorithm, even though you have not thought about it as an algorithm.
And I'll look for the smallest one first, and then the next.
Exactly. And this will take a couple of seconds. But now let's say that I give you a list of 1,000 numbers, and I ask you to sort those. This algorithm that you described will probably take about 10 hours. By hand. Now let's modify the algorithm. Before you do anything, you pick one of those numbers at random. And let's say that the number is, 75. You put it down. Now you run through your list of numbers, and on one side you put those that are less than 75, on the other side those that are more than 75. Now you have two lists of numbers. You sort each of those two lists separately using your simple algorithm, and now you're done, because those that are less than 75 on one side, and those that are more on the other side, this will run about twice as fast as the naive algorithm applied to the entire list. Mm-hmm. So this is an example. And the reason is that because you use randomness, this number that you pick, the 75, will roughly be in the middle of the list. On average, it'll be in the middle of the list.
My guests are Daniel Bienstock, Professor of Industrial Engineering and Operations Research at Columbia University, and Harry Lewis, Gordon McKay, Professor of Computer Science at Harvard University. We're talking about algorithms on today's Please Explain segment here on WNYC, WNYC.org. By the way, I'm Leonard Lopate, and you can call us. We invite your participation. Our number here is 433-9692. That's 212-433-9692. WNYC. I don't know if that's an algorithm. Or you can also write in on our comment line at WNYC.org. Where do we find algorithms in the world today? Because we mostly hear about them in connection to computer programming.
Right.
There were algorithms, as both of you suggested, way before that. But when computers came along, did suddenly people say, hey, this is a perfect place for algorithms?
So what computers provide is they provide scalability. You can take an algorithm that already existed, for example, and implement it as a computer program. And now the computer will be able to run it very fast, much faster than a human being could. And so you can apply that algorithm to vastly larger examples that before were possible. And this is the vehicle for the application.
And that's where we usually think about algorithms. But as we started, Harry, we said that algorithms are common to non-mathematical things in our everyday lives, like tying a shoelace.
Yes, well, juggling, you know, that's another thing where there's sort of fairly complicated sets of rules actually about if you observe what professional jugglers do, or as we said earlier, puzzle solving. We all use algorithms when we learn to play chess or checkers. That actually illustrates another aspect of algorithms, that sometimes you have algorithms that are acting where the data that you're acting on is not static data, but it's an adversary of some kind. Someone you're playing a game against who has, his or her own algorithm that they're applying to sort of analyze, given the position of the chess piece places on the game or whatever, how what to do next. And, these algorithms are, the way we generally think about them, we think we're relying to some degree on rules. You know, people who learn to play chess or checkers memorize a certain number of openings and tend to follow those rules fairly slavishly, and then it sort of goes into things that are more intuition. But there's the reason why those kinds of games are amenable to computerization is that you can develop algorithms that will try to take advantage of any information that's available for developing their next move.
So, although I would assume that on another level, doctors use algorithms to diagnose problems that they are seeing in patients. Because they have to go into certain steps.
And one of the interesting questions is how formal are the rule sets that they are applying. There's actually an interesting story in the New York Times this morning about automated physicians. Maybe some of your readers saw that, which clearly has a lot of algorithms built in to try to simulate what doctors do.
Now, Daniel, I gather not everything can be done with an algorithm. Can you explain what the traveling salesman problem is?
Yes, this is a...
Because up to now, I think that our listeners think everything... Oh, okay, algorithms. Everything is resolved through algorithms, according to this description.
Well, you can try to apply an algorithm to anything, but it may fail. Here's the traveling salesman problem, a simple version. Take a map of the United States, road network, all the major highways, and now you want to travel, visit every city once and return. The rules are that you can visit every city only once, cannot come back. And you would like to do this traveling a minimum distance. Let's compute the shortest way to do this. Until not long ago, this kind of problem was considered unsolvable. Today, it can be solved. This problem that I just stated can be solved with the help of very sophisticated algorithms, multiple algorithms working in symphony, and powerful computers. On the other hand, let's say that I gave you a map of the universe, and now I said, let's travel between every star and come back, and you have to visit every star once. The scale of that problem is such that this super efficient algorithm will no longer be so, will fail.
Now, the U.S. Air Force is supposedly trying to come up with a core algorithm, with core algorithms of human thought. Mm-hmm. Would that be possible?
I'm not sure you understand what it is yet. It seems like a overreaching a little bit.
But is it possible to devise algorithms for human decision-making, for example? Maybe that's what they're trying to think of, which would probably lead to coming up with more serious versions of artificial intelligence.
We don't really understand how the human brain works. I think that would be a prerequisite. You might arrive at a reasonably effective model and then model algorithms on that model, but you wouldn't know really that you're actually representing the human brain. It may yield useful results.
Harry, most people today tend to think of Google when they hear the term algorithm. What kinds of things does Google use algorithms for?
Well, it has a very important set of algorithms in a couple of different areas. One is just how does it retrieve data so incredibly quickly? I mean, if you type, Leonard Lopate into the Google search engine, it doesn't, go out to every website in the world and check them all to see if your name is mentioned. It has a big index that it's built up over a course of maybe weeks. We don't actually know how long it takes to build that index, but the index covers hundreds of thousands or millions of separate disk drives.
Many of them filled with misinformation, but that's a whole other matter.
Well, it's not misinformation. It's not misinformation from Google's standpoint, because all Google claims to be doing is just mirroring what's out there. That's Google's job is just to give you back whatever is out there, and it may be that what's out there is inaccurate, but that's not their fault. That's a separate issue. But what they do try to do is then give you back things that are most relevant. Now, that's a very interesting and slippery term. What they mean by relevant is simply that, if they were to run the experiment over and over again on lots of people, most people would, when they said Leonard Lopate, would click on the page that they have listed at the top. And so they make the judgments about what's relevant based on what people actually click on when they get, when they see things, and they constantly kind of reorder their sense of the quality of a page and the relevance of a page to a particular query based on the enormous amounts of data that they observe just by watching us all use Google.
Well, we have to take a little break. We'll probably talk a bit more about Google as we talk about these things with our listeners. Our number again, 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. You can also leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. My guests on today's Please Explain discussion of algorithms are Harry Lewis, Gordon McKay, Professor of Computer Science at Harvard University, and Daniel Beanstock, Professor of Industrial Engineering and Operations Research at Columbia University. Stay with us for more. We are back with our Please Explain look at algorithms with Daniel Beanstock, Professor of Industrial Engineering and Operations Research at Columbia University, and Harry Lewis, Gordon McKay, Professor of Computer Science at Harvard University. And we invite your calls at 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. Let's go to one of those calls. Mike from the Upper West Side. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Fine. My question is about what kinds of problems are suitable for algorithms, and I'd like to just put my question in context, because I heard two guys give a talk. One of them was Percy Diaconis, and the other one was George Diodatis, who are both, one's a statistician, the other's an engineer, and they were saying that some problems are suitable for algorithms, but others really require heuristics, which will only get you a good answer, but not the right answer. And I wonder if your fellows could elaborate on that.
Okay, well, why don't you start, Daniel?
Yeah, I think this is a matter of semantics. In fact, people might refer to heuristics as heuristic algorithms. What you saw there was a very circumscribed definition of what an algorithm is. I would broaden it to incorporate heuristics as well.
And I'm assuming you agree, Harry?
Yes, I agree. A heuristic algorithm can be formalized. It may have a random component. It may draw on data that isn't superficially what's presented to you, or on lots of deep knowledge. There are problems that are completely unamenable to algorithms. Daniel mentioned one of them, the problems for which it would take more time than there is in the universe to solve using any known algorithm. But there are other problems, like determining whether a computer program is correct, that actually are computationally unsolvable. We actually prove that certain kinds of problems can't be solved by algorithms. But heuristics, I think, from the standpoint of most people who work in the field, is just a special kind of algorithm.
Now, Google's search algorithms are supposedly a secret. Can algorithms be proprietary?
They can, actually.
They can be patented?
They can be patented. I'm not sure that's a good thing, but that's the way the...
Well, if it means that certain ads are going to pop up every time I type something in, is that a good thing?
Well, that's not the danger. The danger is that you'll come around and write some piece of code where you've come up with some clever method for solving it, and then you'll get a letter from the owner of the patent on the algorithm that you stumbled across, and he's going to demand that you pay him. So that's the problem with patenting algorithms. In principle, mathematical formulas are not patentable, but algorithms sometimes are, at least. But this is why there's no shortage of lawyers in the world to fight these things out. Courts have a lot of trouble with it.
Daniel, how do algorithms work in determining the order of listings from a search engine? Because there has also been bit of controversy as to how that sometimes happens with Google. It's not just been pure mathematics.
Right. So as Harry mentioned, we don't really know precisely what it is that Google does. To some degree, the order reflects how popular those websites are. That is to say, how many times people visit them. And this is taken as the surrogate for the relevance. But we don't really know what exactly they do. In addition, in terms of the ads that you observe on the web page, there's an elaborate process, a set of algorithms that you can use to bid, and this determines the order in which you appear. You don't know in advance. You have to bid, and you may make money or not make money, and this determines the order in which your ad will appear in a page served by Google.
But on a purer level, I'm assuming when Netflix and Amazon suggest that if you like this thing, you might also like that other thing, that really just has to do with an algorithm looking
Yes.
into how most people's preferences relate?
Right. The Netflix algorithms, or in particular this Netflix problem that we may have heard about recently, that is very closely related to mathematical statistics, and it does reflect frequencies and so on. So that is correct.
Now, Harry, we've been using computers more and more. I mean, pretty much almost every person right now at one time or another has a connection with the computer. At least if you go to an ATM machine, for example, or if you have...
How about driving a car?
Mm-hmm.
There's probably dozens of computers in your car.
So are we coming across algorithms more frequently than we would have in the past?
Well, there are many more algorithms that are controlling our lives, as I found out, when I took my Toyota Prius into the dealer to have a new algorithm installed in its brakes. That was a software problem with the brakes, that they didn't have the right algorithm, or the algorithm they had some peculiar side effects that they weren't expecting. So yes, as your refrigerator and all kinds of household objects are controlled by smaller and smaller computers that are cheaper and cheaper, the opportunities for algorithms that don't work right or can be improved or whatever, are all around us.
But what about the other way, Daniel? Do algorithms ever influence human behavior?
Well, as you interact with algorithms on a daily basis, it may affect the way you do behave. if you have to withdraw money from an ATM machine, a particular ATM machine that has a weak algorithm, let's say, let's put it that way, you learn to compensate, and it does impact your behavior with that in that respect. And the same in the example of a car. If a car exhibits a certain characteristic in terms of how, for example, it responds to your using the brakes, you may react to that perhaps in an unconscious manner. Mm-hmm. It may impact the way you drive.
You hit the brake a little softer.
Softer or,
little...
or harder or prematurely.
Let's go to another caller. Ron from Keyport, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, great show. And the question I have is about a classic problem called the cocktail party problem. And some mathematicians at Missouri Columbia were able to solve this problem, but not with an algorithm. And this was in 2006. Do the guests know anything about the progress on creating an algorithm for this classic problem?
Is there a different name for the cocktail problem?
No, the cocktail party problem is...
Give us, explain it very quickly, because we have a lot of calls and not all that much time.
Sure. If you imagine a cocktail party where there are 25 conversations going on, your brain can actually zero in and separate one from the others. But to do this using recorded sound is very difficult. Now, the people at Missouri were able to do it using a program that learns, but they haven't been able to come up with a algorithm that would be able to do this every time.
Yeah, taking a step back, there's a very broad field in computer science and applied mathematics that's called compressed sensing. That concerns singling out signals from a noisy background. This field has seen a lot of progress in recent years. There's a lot of mathematics and a lot of algorithms in computing. I am taking a step back from a very particular version of this problem that you mentioned, but it does have many applications, for example, in denoising satellite pictures.
Thank you so much for your call. Harry, can you talk a little bit about how air traffic control is performed with algorithms?
Well, there's a very important application, and you know, there's one where you know, maybe you don't want to use you know, random methods that have a very, very small probability of failing or giving a suboptimal solution, because the consequences of one error every 5 years or so, which would be fine if it was a question of bringing back the right web page in Google, you know, would obviously be catastrophic if it was getting two airplanes into the same airspace by accident. So, but that's a the air traffic control problem is a nice example of geometric problems. There are all kinds of problems that involve geometry, the location of bodies in space, and how you cluster them and how you predict where their motions are going to take them over time. So there's a whole area of computational geometry. You know, those of us of a certain age who learn geometry, I was for thousands of years, most people who learn geometry just learned about, you know, Euclid and the Pythagorean theorem and, you know, analytic geometry and, you know, stuff that was very mathematical and very static and very much about logic. But now geometry is heavily algorithmic because we have so much computer graphics and we have so many problems where we're trying to control transportation systems, and the air traffic control system is a good example of that. And it's also an example of a scheduling problem, which is another area I'm sure Daniel could say more about, where you have a limited number of regularly spaced opportunities to get planes down on the ground, and you have planes arriving at a certain distribution of somewhat unpredictable times into the airspace, and how do you get the maximum number of planes on the ground with the minimum number of occasions where the planes have to turn around and take another loop, which are extremely costly for the airlines.
This sounds like video games expanded into the real world.
It's just an example of many such problems. So take an enterprise like a parcel delivery service, UPS, and so on. They solve problems like this with this sort of flavor on a daily basis, routing their trucks to pick up and make deliveries. They want to optimize their use of fuel and such. They're very constrained.
They actually changed. There was a nice story recently. They actually changed their algorithm, at least in some domains. So they only calculated routes that involved only right turns. So they discovered by eliminating left turns, they actually produced more efficient scheduling of their trucks.
Well, that's a political thing. Don't traders on Wall Street also use algorithms? And considering the fact that we've had so many problems on Wall Street, can they be wrong sometimes? Can algorithms be wrong?
When you craft an algorithm, you're making assumptions about the space in which the algorithm will operate. If the assumptions are wrong, then it's a disaster. But yes,
subprime mortgages,
for example, yes, you assume that something will happen. One common thread in the algorithms that you find in use in Wall Street is that they're really up to a point, but they want the future to be much like the past was. They're banking on this. And so when they observe a situation on a given day where, let's say, the price of a stock is deviating from where it should be, then they bet that this will correct. In a nutshell, this is how the Wall Street algorithms proceed. They are quite sophisticated. In addition, many of the people in Wall Street have a background in the sciences and so on. They try to borrow paradigms. This further complicates the applicability and the complexity of the algorithms.
Are there algorithms for designing algorithms, Harry?
Well, there's you know, the design of algorithms is it's partly a craft. I mean, it's a little bit like designing buildings. You know, you can, you know, somebody gives you a problem about that they want to build a office building, you know, and you start thinking about other office buildings you've seen, and you know, it's, you know, you start thinking about whether it's going to be made out of steel or wood or something like that, and you've got trained computer scientists have a pretty good inventory of algorithms they know about that have been useful in solving other problems in the past, and then you try to customize, and then you do experiments and see, you know, on simulated data.
Well, how is that all that different from designing a recipe for a cake or figuring out a pattern for knitting?
Well, at some level, it isn't. You draw. Maybe it's more quantitative in terms of the analysis of whether it, whether the algorithm is having the desired result. You have more, you know, a more objective criterion of success than you will in these more, aesthetic realms. But it is a combination of drawing on experience and then making variations to suit the needs of the particular problem that's been put before you.
We're pretty much out of time, but you can refine a recipe, Daniel. Can you refine an algorithm?
Sure. Algorithms can refine themselves. You can have an algorithm that's running continuously, for example, an autopilot algorithm that's flying a plane, and if it observes that a particular rule that it's been applying is no longer the right rule, weather conditions have changed, it'll change and do something better.
Thank you both so much for being with us. Daniel Bienstock, Professor of Industrial Engineering and Operations Research at Columbia University. Harry Lewis, Gordon McKay, Professor of Computer Science at Harvard University. We've been talking about algorithms on Please Explain in a studio that I think probably relies an awful lot on algorithms and a radio system that relies a lot on algorithms. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Bye.